Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
How many times have we heard this?
My American dream is to have a family.
So I'm going to spend as much time with my family as possible
to make my family happy and to protect them.
I have a really large family. And I'm
sick of a job ruining a life that I should be spending enjoying my family.
In politics, spending time with family often means dropping out because you can't win an election. Senator Chris Dodd isn't using euphemisms to explain his retirement. Yes, he wants to spend time with his wife, but also...
Any certain prediction about an election victory or defeat nearly a year from now would be absurd.
In Dodd's case, his departure is probably a good thing for the Democrats, and one thing's clear, he'll be spending more quality time on his couch, where he's the only candidate. On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Thursday, January 7th. And the takeaway here, John, is it time to get rid of spending time with family as the reason why you're leaving politics?
You know, they never ask the family what they believe on this day.
Spend more time with us?
Please, no. Let's get right to the top stories we're following this morning. We're learning more about the stepped-up security on airplanes that the president referred to yesterday. ABC News is reporting that President Obama has ordered a surge of federal air marshals to be in place by the end of the month. The plan is to deploy 3,000 more marshals, almost exclusively to international flights, while personnel from agencies like Border Patrol and Secret Service will pick up the slack on domestic flights. Officials say even administrative officials are being told to get out of their offices and onto planes. Later today, President Obama will let the public have a closer look at the missteps that preceded that attempted airliner attack on Christmas Day. The White House will release a declassified account of what happened, and President Obama will address the nation about the findings and recommendations.
There's another security misstep we're learning about this morning. The LA Times is reporting that U.S. security officials plan to question the suspected bomber once his plane landed in Detroit. Customs officials found his name on a watch list, but the plane was already in the air.
So here at home, President Obama is pushing for a tax on high-priced insurance policies as Democrats wrangle over the final health care bills. House Democrats are resisting since that tax would affect a number of union-sponsored health care plans.
Democrats hope passing a health care bill will help them keep their congressional edge, but Larry Sabato of the University of Virginia says they should be worried about the retirement this week of two Democratic senators.
They signal real trouble for Democrats in 2010. Now, we've known for a long time 2010 was going to be a Republican year. The only question is, how Republican?
We're joined now by New York Times reporter Jeff Zeleny. Does Larry Sabato's claim hold up, Jeff, that 2010 will be a Republican year, even though there's news that six Republican senators are bowing out as well?
Democrats are the party in power, so Republicans are supposed to be retiring. Democrats are supposed to be staying.
Okay, so is there a difference between the character of these retirements? Is there a difference between those coming from the Democrats and those on the Republican side?
Well, there is, because the Democrats are chairmen of committees. They're more powerful because they are in the majority. So Republican retirements were more expected. The Democrats were more of a surprise.
Jeff, stay with us. We'll be back with you in just a moment. GM has high hopes for 2010. Speaking to reporters yesterday, the new CEO, Ed Whitaker, says he believes the company will return to profitability this year. That's going to be tough. However, GM did lose $1.2 billion in the third quarter of 2009.
And Ford's way ahead of them.
Here's the big news question.
Okay.
Are you a dog or a cat person?
Not a cat person.
A new AP poll shows Americans like dogs better than cats, and it's not even close. 74% say they prefer man's best friend. That puts me strongly in the majority there.
Okay.
Taking a look at markets, Asian and European markets are down, and futures are down as well. The Dow will start at 10,573, the S&P at 1,137, and the NASDAQ at 2301.
Our tech segment this Thursday is right in the headlines. What is the technological issue in mining databases of intelligence information to actually produce actionable kinds of decisions that would prevent someone who's a terrorist from getting on an airplane? We're going to talk about that. And the takeaway question is on something completely different. Can you hear the dolphins cry? Scientists at Emory University in Atlanta can. They say dolphins are so intelligent, they actually deserve the status of non-human persons. What do you think about that? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. Politics coming up.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning. The Democratic Party has lost a few of its stars this week, Byron Dorgan of North Dakota and Senator Chris Dodd from Connecticut.
In the long sweep of American history, there are moments for each elected public official to step aside and let someone else step up. This is my moment to step aside.
But some of the Republicans are stepping aside as well. They're going to have to defend open Senate seats in New Hampshire, Ohio, and Missouri after a series of retirements last year. On Monday, South Carolina Representative Henry E. Brown became the 14th Republican to announce that he will not run for re-election this year. Joining us now is Ron Kaufman, who is a former White House political director, and he's the Republican National Committeeman for Massachusetts, close friend and advisor to Mitt Romney. Good morning, Ron.
Good morning, Celeste. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for joining us.
Love to do it.
So in order for the Republicans to take the majority in the House, for example, they would need 40 seats in the 2010 election. And Republican National Committee Chairman Michael Steele was asked on Fox News about whether he thought that was possible.
We're going to see, I think, nice pickups in the House. I think we're going to see nice...
More specific.
I can't give a number yet, because like I said, we're just now beginning to look at the races, and we have races where it hasn't been clear...
Do you think he could take over the House?
Candidate.
You think Republicans...
Not this year. And, Sean, I'll say honestly...
You don't think so?
Well, I don't know yet, because I don't know who all the candidates... We still have some vacancies that need to get filled.
Ron Kaufman, how do you respond to that? Do you think the Republicans could take over the House?
Well, I'm glad to have this conversation, Celeste. A year ago, the Republican Party was in ashes. In sackcloth and on the way out the door. And now we're talking about can we pick up enough seats to gain control of the House. My guess is it will be a great year. How many, who knows? But I think that this is going to be one of the best Republican years we've had since 1994.
That might be a rosy picture. We have four big-name Republicans stepping down, Voinovich, Bond, Mel Martinez in Florida, Brownback in Kansas. I'm wondering, and in some of those places, it's going to be difficult for the Republicans to keep control of those Senate seats. But do you think that's an opportunity to maybe get some more new faces and maybe some more diverse candidates?
Well, I think what happened on Monday when you had three big-time Democrats step down, all of which were... two of which were very strong, supposedly, and left their seats to Republican challengers, proves that the fact is this is a Republican year. People out there are angry. They're upset with health care. They're upset with lack of transparency that was promised. They're upset with the debt. They're upset with the spending. And when people are upset, they're upset with incumbents. This is going to be an anti-incumbent year, and there'll be some Republicans, quite frankly, that may pay the price, too. But there's a whole much more Democrats to be upset with than there are Republicans.
Okay, well, you are the Republican National Committeeman for Massachusetts, and, of course, the late Kennedy's Senate seat is going to be up for election on January 19th. What's your strategy to win that seat? Do you think you can win it?
Well, I think we can. And, again, I can't believe I'm saying that myself, Celeste, to be honest with you. But in recent polling data on Monday showed that it was in single numbers, and no one would have thought that. We got a great candidate who is raising tons of money over the Internet. He's raised more money than a Democrat has. That's never happened in Massachusetts. Literally tens of thousands of dollars are coming in over the transom.
Tens of thousands? That's
tens.
Not huge. That's not that big.
Well, let's just say he's raised, John, more money than she has. When is the last time a Republican unknown candidate has taken on a Democrat in Massachusetts and raised more? Mitt Romney, when he ran against Ted Kennedy in 94, didn't raise more money than Ted Kennedy.
Because he had more in his pocket.
Okay. Ron Kaufman, thanks so much. He's a former White House political director, Republican National Committeeman from Massachusetts. He joined us from Washington, D.C. Let's move on now to Jeff Zeleny. Again, joins us. He's the White House correspondent from the New York Times. Jeff, you just heard what Ron Kaufman was saying. And he's talking about the candidate in Massachusetts raising tens of thousands of dollars. But the RNC is heading into this election year with less money than they've ever had. They only have about $9 million in the bank. Is the picture for Republicans as rosy as Ron Kaufman thinks?
Well, I think it actually, I mean, he's right. It's much rosier than we would have anticipated a year ago. I mean, President Obama has not even been in office 1 year, and he came into Washington on the back of a historic Democratic sweep. The party looked strong. The party looked like it was together. Now the Republicans have coalesced around being against his agenda, and it has strengthened the party, no question. So it's in a stronger position than people thought it would. I'm not sure it's in as strong a position as it needs to be, you know, but it's only January. So The financial situation, though, is very interesting. If the Supreme Court rules on a campaign finance case in the coming weeks, essentially overturning the McCain-Feingold campaign finance restrictions, all the rules are off. Unlimited corporate contributions will be allowed, and the financial situation between Republicans and Democrats will be absolutely equal.
Okay, well, Carl Rove said after President Obama's victory that history will favor the Republicans in 2010. What did he mean by that?
Well, he's absolutely right on that. Only two times since 1934 in a midterm election has the party of the president actually won in the midterms. So remember 1994, the second year of Bill Clinton's term, Democrats were trounced. So what he means by that, history is always on the side, or almost always on the side, of the opposing party. So Mr. Rove is right in his historical assessment, and Democrats know this. The White House knows they're going to lose seats in the midterm elections. They're just not sure how many.
Well, let's talk for a minute about Chris Dodd and also Byron Dorgan of North Dakota. These two high-profile retirements, does that signal weakness in the part of the Democrats?
I mean, and essentially, it was actually an opportunity yesterday for Democrats and a bit of a wash. Senator Dodd has served in Washington for almost 30 years, but he had become embattled. So many Democrats privately were relieved that he is out of the race because they think they have a better shot of winning it. But overall, it does signal weakness a bit because he's now a chairman of a powerful committee. Democrats, when they're in power, are not supposed to retire. You're supposed to have more Republican retirements, and because of these senators are not the committee chairman, they're sort of sick of being in the minority. So it does signal some sign of weakness for Democrats. When they're supposed to be the party of power, their presidents in the White House, these guys aren't supposed to be the ones who are retiring.
Okay, so Jeff Zeleny of the New York Times, do you think we need to come up with a different phrase for people like Chris Dodd other than "I'm spending time with my family"?
I think he said it pretty well yesterday. He acknowledged that he's going to be doing that, but he wouldn't be doing this if he thought he was going to win in November. He'd be going back to the Senate, so he'll have some time with his family. But he has young kids, so
we'll see
what the next phrase is on the next retirements.
Might actually be fun.
Might wear him out.
Yeah. Should we ask Jeff?
Yeah, the takeaway question.
Yeah, absolutely.
Jeff, we have to ask you this because our takeaway question today is about dolphin rights.
Yeah, some scientists believe that dolphins, because of the size of their
rights.
Brain,
they may be as smart as humans. Some say possibly smarter. What do you think?
It's hard to tell. I mean, sometimes some of the people in Washington sort of seem like, dolphins or sort of going past.
That's
an
insult
on this.
To the mammals of the ocean there.
That's true.
Jeff Zeleny, New York Times White House correspondent, thanks so much. And we're asking you, what do you think? Should the measure of your intelligence give you rights? And are there any other animals deserve personhood status? What do you mean?
As an animal. Well,
as opposed to humans?
Right. Well, should intelligent humans get more rights than non-intelligent humans? You're not saying that.
No. Animals only. Animals only. 877 my take or my take
here.
At thetakeaway.org.
President Obama's national security advisor says the preliminary report into the mistakes that led to the attempted terror attack on an airliner will give readers a, quote, shock. In an interview with USA Today, General James Jones says people will be surprised that clues weren't connected. The White House releases a declassified version of that report today. ABC News is reporting, meanwhile, that the president has ordered a surge of federal air marshals by the end of the month, more than 3,000 air marshals deployed on overseas flights.
And finally, Baltimore Mayor Sheila Dixon fought back tears as she announced her resignation.
I'm sad not because of the decision I made, but because I have a great staff. Work hard.
There was no public apology to join those tears, though. Dixon resigned following allegations that she stole gift cards intended for the poor. We'll talk about that more later this hour. So look at some of the stories you're watching this morning coming up.
Tiger, turn to the Christian faith, and you can make a total recovery and be a great example to the world.
Not much offends Buddhists. We're a pretty tolerant folk as it goes, but we're going to talk about how Fox's Brit Hume may have actually gotten Buddhists ticked off.
Should have tried to give Tiger golf advice, maybe.
Hey, you want that to go?
Now, time for some takeouts on news stories that we're following. And John, I'm not sure if this is a takeout on media, religion, or sports. Fox News analyst Brit Hume had some advice for Tiger Woods this past weekend.
The extent to which he can recover, it seems to me, depends on his faith. He's said to be a Buddhist. I don't think that faith offers the kind of forgiveness and redemption that is offered by the Christian faith. So my message to Tiger would be, Tiger, Turn your faith, turn to the Christian faith, and you can make a total recovery and be a great example to the world.
So he's saying that Christianity is an upgrade from Buddhism?
Yeah, I think he's saying that if he were a Buddhist, if he were not a Buddhist, he'd be a better person. Joining us now is Robert Thurman, a professor of Buddhist studies at Columbia University. Robert, in the full interest of disclosure, I myself am a Buddhist and my hackles are up. But explain this to me, this idea that Christianity reveres forgiveness and Buddhism does not. Is that true?
No, that is not true. I think both religions revere forgiveness. All religions revere forgiveness, and they encourage that good quality in people, and they have intercessors or messiah figures of various types who try to help the beings find the right path and overcome having the problem of doing something negative or sinful.
I think also, you know, there's this idea that Buddhists don't quote-unquote believe in Jesus. That's not entirely true either.
Well, there are some people who think that, even maybe some Buddhists will say that, because Buddhists who have converted from a Western tradition tend to try to differentiate themselves from the monotheistic traditions. And so they'll say, well, we don't have sin, we don't have this and that. But of course they do. Any tradition that has ethics has evil, which is when you break ethical commandments, such as Tiger did. He committed adultery, and he needs the forgiveness of his wife, especially. That's what he really needs. And he needs to repent his own behavior and get back on the sort of straight and narrow.
Okay.
But that's really none of our business to tell him. That's his business and his family. And Brit Hume was way out of line there. And actually, he can see that Buddhists are very forgiving because nobody's really raised too much of a fuss about it.
Yeah, the Dalai Lama hasn't been on Fox.
Exactly, and that's another Buddhist thing. None of our business is very much more Buddhist.
Absolutely.
Christianity, it's our business, okay? Maybe a little more?
Yeah.
You think Christianity's a little more nosy than Buddhists are on stuff like this?
No, I don't think so. I think everybody is quite similar. And the thing is, another thing is that he's being kind of rude to Christianity, I think, Brit Hume. He really needs a little comparative religion in education by implying that somehow his sins will all be just taken care of if he just converts to Christianity, and indicating in a way implicitly that Christianity is not an ethical religion and that his ethical misdeeds will not haunt him, whatever his religion. And Jesus would certainly not agree with that if you read the Gospels. And so he really needs a little upgrade in his religious understanding, Mr. Hume does.
See, this is the problem with starting a fight with a Buddhist, Robert Thurman, professor of Buddhist studies at Columbia University, because you're just not taking the bait. I mean, you know, to say things like, I don't agree, it's okay, he's misled, that's no way to get into a fight.
Well, you can't start a fight with a Buddhist, right?
Yeah, I don't know if he really. I guess he thinks that Buddhists don't exist. He's just living in his Fox News world where fundamentalists rule, and he thinks it's just fine to do that and ingratiate himself with fundamentalists about Jesus. But he's being rude to Jesus, rude to Buddhists, and he needs a little, as I said, a little upgrade in his own education.
Robert, can I ask you just one thing? You know, some people have said that Brit Hume was proselytizing as a Christian, and he maybe gets points for doing that publicly. Is there a tradition of that in Buddhism, of proselytizing, of conversion?
No, not really. There is a tradition of people being happy about their own faith in some way, saying that what I do is nice or what I believe is nice. Or that's a normal thing for people to do. But in the position of being on television as a pundit, in a way that was proselytizing, I think even Bill O'Reilly was teasing him that he was proselytizing. I heard that. And he was kind of mumbling, well, gee, I don't know, or something like that. And so that was, he was sort of saying to people, everyone should convert to Christianity and they'll all be fine. And that's not fair to either Christianity. Why does Christianity want all the sinners? They don't. Everybody has their own sinners, and everybody should take care of them themselves.
You know? Good point. Robert Thurman, professor of Buddhist studies at Columbia University. Thanks. And I should, let me just point out here.
We learn watches O'Reilly.
Right. But here's the thing for me. I have to tell you that one of the five no-nos in Buddhism is sexual misconduct.
Yeah, yeah, he couldn't have justified himself, Tiger Woods couldn't.
No,
as a Buddhist,
he was in trouble as a Buddhist also.
Well, how do you justify the kinds of things that Elvis ate in his, well, how many years of life? He has a birthday coming up this week, 75 tomorrow. And we started the celebrations early. We asked you about some of his favorite foods, the king of bad-for-you comfort foods, also the king of rock and roll, but peanut butter and nanner sandwiches, that's what Elvis liked to eat. But what are you eating?
This is Nancy from Charlotte, North Carolina. My favorite comfort food is sweet potato pudding with marshmallows on top, just the way Grandma used to make it.
Comfort food? Oh, either ravioli or ziti with gobs of tomato sauce, no meat, and some sautéed vegetables if I can get to them. Followed by a hot fudge sundae with buttercrunch ice cream, gobs of hot fudge, and just a touch of marshmallow.
Just a touch. A touch. A smidge of marshmallow. David in Enid, Oklahoma writes, take your pick. Cheese and crackers, homemade huevos rancheros, my wife's lasagna or enchiladas, garlic smashed potatoes, buffalo wings.
And is there anything that's not a comfort food for you, David? Jean has a suggestion straight out of Asia. She writes on our site, thetakeaway.org, my mom's version of ochazuke, canned tuna and green tea over leftover rice. I pour the leftover tea on the rice, microwave it, and add a dash of soy sauce.
That sounds great. The king wouldn't eat something that good for you, but how about this from Sean in Oklahoma City? Bobo's chicken in northeast Oklahoma, smoked, deep fried, baked, and smothered in honey.
Holy cow.
What's your suggestion? 877-8-MY-TAKE. Coming up, Freakonomics.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up,
Super Freakonomics.
We talk with Freakonomics co-author Stephen Dubner about the fear of flying. Since when is fear ever rational? But he explains the rationale of fear after the Christmas Day plot in just a few moments. Here's some news stories, though, what we're following at 30 minutes after the hour. Later today, we'll get a look at the report about the security breakdown in the failed Christmas airliner attack. It's an unclassified version of the report that the president received. After three senior Democrats announced yesterday they won't run for re-election, Republicans smell blood. On the Takeaway this morning, Ron Kaufman, the Republican National Committeeman, said the GOP is ready to take advantage of what he calls public anger around the nation.
They're upset with health care. They're upset with lack of transparency that was promised. They're upset with the debt. They're upset with the spending. And when people are upset, they're upset with incumbents.
Six Republican senators, though, are also not running for re-election this year.
Fox News is reporting this morning that the authorities are looking for a 16-year-old Yemeni boy who is recruited by al-Qaeda to become a suicide bomber. They believe he's targeting the port city of Aden, which was the site of the USS Cole bombing back in 2000. Mayor Bloomberg says the security costs of hosting the trials of 9/11 suspect Khalid Sheikh Mohammed may top $200 million this year. He wants Washington to cover the costs. And a Kentucky auto worker has a distracted convenience store clerk to thank for this. Get this, right? $128 million Powerball win. Whew. The man meant to buy three $1 lotto tickets as stocking stuffers, but the clerk made a mistake, ruined the guy's whole Christmas, or what seemed like a mistake at the time. $128 million Powerball mistake. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Ooh, Freakonomics.
So, in the news, huge stories often begin with just a single spark, right? Stampede journalism. You heard of this, right? Well, when a young man attempted to detonate explosives on a Detroit-bound flight on Christmas Day, the news media stampeded, air travelers stampeded. The question of fear of flying is raised in almost everybody's mind. The question is it realistic? Which is a job for, of course,
Super Freakonomics.
Which is why Stephen Dubner, co-author of Super Freakonomics, Global Cooling, Patriotic Prostitutes, and Why Suicide Bombers Should Buy Life Insurance, is here in the studio. You also are the author of the Freakonomics blog on thenewyorktimes.com. Good morning.
Good morning. Happy New Year.
You know, this is a bit of a reminder. We're not going to break any new ground here necessarily, but once again, a single simple event, a terrorism event, a failed terrorism attack, produces enormous consequences in the economy and in the sort of psyches of Americans and other air travelers. Is it realistic?
Well, it's kind of a two-parter, because is it realistic? Well, terrorism is real, and it claims real victims, and they're tragic. The problem is it depends how you want to assess these things from a cost perspective,
let's
right?
Let's calculate. Let's do some calculation.
Right. So if you're a politician or if you're the loved one of someone who dies in a terrorist attack, then terrorism can be number one priority, and it's hard to blame. Now, the politician's feeling and the victim's family's feelings are obviously very different. but one is driven by the other. It does make me think, however, this recent attack, whether it was successful or not, fortunately, thank God it was unsuccessful, but whether it's successful or not, does make me think back to 2001, right before September 11. What happened right before September 11 was known as the Summer of the Shark.
That's right.
Right?
It was Gary Condit and shark attacks.
Yeah, Gary Condit and shark attacks, and it was the cover of Time magazine. It was all over. Now, if you look back at the data from that year and from years before and after, you'd expect to see this huge spike. You'd expect to see a shark-like fin rising up from the data, right?
Based on the amount of attention that was being devoted to this.
The coverage, the hysteria, the number of people who weren't going anywhere near the beach and so on. Turns out that year in 2001, worldwide, there were four fatal shark attacks, which was about the same as there were the 10 years previous and there were the 8 or 10 years after that. It turns out more people are probably killed every year getting run over by TV news vans who go to cover the shark attacks, okay? So it's very easy to generate. Now, does that mean that if you're the loved one of someone who was killed that you feel it's inconsequential? Absolutely not. Terrorism is different because it exacts societal costs, as we're now seeing.
All right, how do you do the shark attack calculation for, say, the shoe bomber or for some other famous terrorism attack that we know about?
Well, yeah, that's a point we make that terrorism, one of the things that makes it so hard, so difficult, and so time-consuming is that it's very efficient. If you think about it like a physicist, terrorism has huge leverage. It exerts a great cost even when it fails. When it succeeds, yes, but even when it fails. So if you think about Richard Reed, the shoe bomber, who, again, was unsuccessful. Let's look at the cost. Let's say it takes an average of 1 minute to remove and replace your shoes in the airport security.
We should note that because of Richard Reed, everybody had to take their shoes off in the security.
Right. We all used to joke, thank goodness he didn't put in his underpants, so we'd be stripping down. So now that's what we're looking at.
Yeah, I didn't joke, but maybe you did.
I'm guessing you actually did more than I. But anyway,
possibly,
that's a personality conflict. We won't get into that. But in the United States alone, the procedure of taking off shoes and putting them back on, let's say it happens about 560 million times a year.
A lot of shoes.
Wow.
So that time, 560 million minutes, is about 1,065 years, which divided by 77.8 years, which is the average U.S. life expectancy at birth today, that's a total of nearly 14 person lives. So even though Richard Reed failed to kill a single person, he did levy a tax that is the time equivalent of 14 person lives per year. That's one way to look at it.
Not to mention the fact that I actually bought 3 pairs of shoes, different styles that slip on and off.
Well,
that's interesting.
That is often undiscussed. There are people who benefit every time something like this happens. You know, every time you have to throw away your Bic lighter now, well, Bic gets to sell another one on the other side. But I'm also thinking that some people are buying a little bit nicer underwear this time
around. All right, but this statistic will impress your friends at parties, like all the super freakonomic stuff is. But in terms of concrete policy, should there have been a different approach to the shoe bomber than taking off the shoes? Should profiling be what we are focusing on rather than just a blanket removal of all shoes?
I think like any big problem, the short answer is that if it were an easy problem, we wouldn't be sitting here talking about it. The short answer is it is a really hard problem. When someone wants to do harm, and we live in an open society, they can do harm. That's the short answer, and that's the depressing answer. The harder answer is what do you do and how do you spend your resources wisely? I think, like a lot of really difficult problems, the answer isn't any one thing. I think the point is that when you're fighting crime, when you're fighting poverty, it's going to be a portfolio thing. So we do write about the fact that, yeah, there are a lot of ways you try to stop. If you try to stop terrorism by, however, looking at money transfers, forget it. If you look at the amount of money that the September 11th bombers, attackers used in compared to the amount of money that's slushing through international banks every day, forget it. If you're
it's like $10,000 versus $20 trillion
daily.
So when Barack Obama stands up and says, "We're going to analyze this data better, we're going to do our intelligence better, and we're going to solve this problem," you say,
"Well, we say yes. We said that."
But is it doable? Is it a super freakonomics calculation that actually is reasonable?
We write about a process in Britain where we worked in concert with a British banker to screen millions of customers from this bank to find markers that identify a potential terrorist. And we feel we've been successful, and that list of potential bad guys has been handed off to MI5.
But if I'm a terrorist and I read your book, can't I just do the opposite of everything you say identifies me as a terrorist?
You might like to think so, and I can tell you that we're a little bit smarter than that. So the short answer is no. The short answer is no.
Let's talk to El Al. The former security guy at El Al, the Israeli National Airline.
And that works.
He says profile absolutely everybody.
Absolutely, of course.
You think that's realistic? You've flown at El Al?
Yeah, I have flown LL, and it works for a variety of reasons. And I think one big misconception is that it's much more resource and time intensive. It's not, in part because they start the questioning at the ticket counter rather than at the security line. It doesn't create that kind of bottleneck. I like a lot of people, like a lot of bright people, like Bruce Schneier, I think you've had on the show.
Yeah, sure.
You know, security theater is theatrical. It's not necessarily very effective.
So the Christmas Day bombing happens, you're lying in bed, you roll over, somebody tells you, you say, nah, honey, it's no big deal. It's just super Freakonomics. Come on.
Well, no, I don't say that. I think there are costs to pay in society, and we need to try to spend resources more smartly than we do, and it's a tragedy that it almost happened.
Well, that's why we come to you in the studio to help you help us with all of this. Stephen Dubner, of course, is the co-author of Super Freakonomics, Global Cooling, Patriotic Prostitutes, and Why Suicide Bombers Should Buy Life Insurance. I love these kinds of calculations. Coming up, we're going to continue this discussion. Our tech segment every Thursday is all about the difficulties of trying to mine complicated databases to get actionable information to prevent terrorism. It's a tech question. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee.
And it was with deep regret and sadness that I'm resigning from mayor of Baltimore effective February the 4th.
Mayor Sheila Dixon is resigning after 3 years in office. The announcement was made yesterday, 1 month after she was convicted for embezzling about $500 in gift cards that were intended for low-income residents. The news of her resignation was actually broken by our next guest, Mark Steiner. He's host of The Mark Steiner Show on WEAA in Baltimore. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Celeste. How are you?
I am doing well. So the mayor, after at least a month, perhaps more, of people calling for her resignation, has resigned. Does she leave office immediately?
No, she leaves office on February the 4th. That was part of the plea agreement.
And who's stepping in for her after she goes?
The president of the city council steps up and becomes the next mayor of Baltimore, the acting mayor of Baltimore, until the next election, which is in about 2 years.
Okay, so Stephanie Rawlings-Blake is a black woman. She's the president of the city council.
That's right.
She'll be taking over there, and she'll be there for as you said, 2 years. Does that make this a racial story?
Well, in Baltimore there always is. That part is that the battle over the city council presidency. There are some African-American politicians who are gathering to ensure that the next president of city council will be an African-American and not somebody white.
Right. So the issue isn't that she's taking over. There's not a racial component to her taking over the mayor's office. It's over the fight for her seat as the president of the city council.
That's right.
Well, here's a listener that you had on your show yesterday.
I find her attitude to be arrogant. I moved from Washington, D.C., and to me, she reminds me of Mayor Ernst Berry a little bit. She does wrong, and then she thinks that she can just, her attitude is portrayed as, well, I'm the mayor. I can get away and do what I want to do and say what I want to do without any consequences.
And now that's Russell speaking about the outgoing mayor, Sheila Dixon, not about her replacement. Is that kind of typical of the responses you got from listeners?
It's really mixed, but the majority of responses fit that listener. I would say over 60%. She's lost a lot of the empathy and support she had as this kind of gritty blue-collar mayor. And I think that's a pretty widely held opinion.
Well, I think part of that is because she stole things that were intended for the poor.
Right, exactly. I mean, it's as small as the amount was she was convicted of, $500 of gift cards, they were meant for poor children. And that I think, turned the city around and away from her.
How do you feel about all this, Mark? I mean, do you feel like you bagged a mayor, or do you feel like you've performed a public service?
I don't know. I think it's a tragedy all the way around. It's a tragedy for the city, it's a tragedy for Sheila Dixon. And all we did was just know what was going on and had people inside City Hall that knew us and made the phone call saying the mayor just had a private meeting with her chief staff saying that she's resigning. And that's when we broke the story and when we also found out that she prayed with her pastor, Frank Reed. And so we just went ahead and said, well, we know these people, so let's just say she's going to resign today. And that's what happened there.
And what happens over the next 2 years with the sitting mayor coming in? Is there going to be a real change in politics in Baltimore?
There could be. I mean, there was no love lost between the president, city council, and the mayor. So we'll have very different people in place. The biggest issue is going to be the police commissioner, who so many people are afraid that the new mayor will replace, and who's been doing a lot of cultural changes inside the police department. And so there are going to be some differences. And the battle is still looming. There's all kinds of rumors about former NAACP president Kwesi Mfume running for mayor of Baltimore. So there's all those things going on in the city. So this could be a very interesting political time.
Well, it's always interesting in Baltimore. Thanks so much, Mark Steiner, host of The Mark Steiner Show on WEAA.
He's the best. He is great. John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee. Coming up, the technological complexities in sharing intelligence information, if it's all bottled up in complicated databases. It's a computer technological issue, and we're going to talk about it. Today we're asking you about something also a little bit different.
They call him Flipper, Flipper, faster than light.
Well, scientists at Emory University in Atlanta call Flipper eligible for rights because of the size of the brain and the clearly intelligent qualities of dolphins. What other animals should get so-called personhood status because of their intelligence and behavioral sophistication? Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. We're going to talk to those scientists later on in the hour. Right out now, here is a check on leading stories at 48 minutes after this hour. The latest weekly figures are out on the number of people claiming unemployment benefits after 2 weeks of sharp drops. Last week saw an increase, but it was less than expected. Several advances this morning on the failed airline attack story. The LA Times says while security officials realized the Nigerian man on board the plane was suspicious, the plane was in the air already. They planned to interview him when the plane landed. Meanwhile, Yemen's government says the suspect met last month with the cleric linked to that Fort Hood shooter, and President Obama will tell us more later when he gives a speech at around 1 p.m. today on the missteps that followed that incident on Christmas Day.
And some interesting medical news. New experiments on mice suggest long-term exposure to mobile phone radiation may prevent the onset of the disease and may even reverse its symptoms. More exhaustive studies now being called for. These are some of the news stories that we're following this morning.
Our tech segment this week actually stays with the headlines. The president suggests that we need to analyze data better. Our intelligence databases have lots of information in them, but if we analyzed it correctly, we could actually prevent the kinds of attacks that happened on Christmas Day, where that Detroit airplane was boarded by a man with explosives in his underwear. He wasn't able to carry out the attack, but we're living the consequences. Joining us now is Michael Tanji, former senior intelligence officer and current senior fellow at the Center for Threat Awareness. He's a columnist for Wired Magazine's Danger Room. He joins us from Virginia. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
And Dr. Nelson Ludlow is the CEO of Intellicheck Mobiliza, which designed an international security database system recently purchased by the TSA and now being used at Andrews Air Force Base. He joins us from Seattle. Good morning, Doctor.
Good morning. Thank you.
So to both of you, Michael, let me begin with just a concrete example here. If I Google Nigerian radical flight today, I get something on the order of like 3 million references, most of which are probably references to the news. I'm wondering if that had been a search prior to Christmas Day, we still would have gotten probably 100,000. How difficult a technical question is it when you're cross-referencing databases to narrow it down to 2 rather than 200 or 200,000?
Well, actually, the nice thing about being working with in a security environment, an intelligence environment, is you're not you may use Google as a tool, but you're accessing a much smaller set of data. So you're not going across the whole internet. Sticking with the example of a TSA or a Border Patrol officer, being able to look for that sort of information, you would access a lot smaller set of data. So your results would be a little bit better.
But nevertheless, and Dr. Ludlow, let me bring you on this. If you have a group of, say, even 100 suspects, how do you narrow it down effectively to be able to take action in the time it takes, say, someone like Abdulmutallab to get from the gate where he bought his ticket to the security checkpoint to the boarding gate and then actually on to the plane?
Well, the technology, we can obviously do a lot better than what we're currently doing. If a no-fly list only has 5,000 people, well, okay, that's obviously workable. But you know what? Even if there's this larger list, which this Nigerian guy was on, which is a little bit over 500,000 names, obviously a computer can do that. We just need to be able to get that information to the people right there at the TSA agent so they can do something useful with it.
Michael Tanji, I have a sense that the way the government operates its databases, and I'm probably wrong on this, is that they're just various pools of information and that the deficiency is in how that information is shared and how significance is assigned to individual aspects. Dad called and said he's a radical. He purchases a ticket that's only one way, doesn't actually check any bags, that kind of thing.
Yeah, so you have multiple databases, and the problem is less about how much data or the accuracy or speed. It's about the process of sharing. So let's say, for example, Border Patrol or TSA might have had, State Department might have had some excellent information that someone could have acted upon, but the process to get that information to Border or TSA, based on a couple of stories that just came out, you know, it was slow, it was late, it was incomplete. It's really a process of that. It's not just the raw information, but being able to get it to the right place at the right time with the supplemental information, such as, by the way, the would-be bomber's father showed up, and we think this is a significant thing to pay attention to. Right.
And, of course, all this information is very, very time-sensitive. What would it take technologically? Because I'm noticing that once you have the name of the suspect, and, of course, after Christmas, we knew exactly who this person was and what he was trying to do, you put that name into databases and all kinds of information comes up. How hard would it be to create a system that would cause someone like this suspect to pause at an airport long enough to run that kind of data? And then you would have known. Michael?
The problem, of course, is that terrorists have the advantage of a much larger pool of folks to tap to carry out attacks. So you might not have any idea who is going to be coming next. The focus, that's where you're going to try to focus on your screening procedures and making sure that all those things like, you know, not having luggage, paying cash one way, are going to tip off the trigger. That really should have been the reason that would-be bomber did not get on the plane. All the other things that it had nothing to do with databases, but everything to do with behavior,
right,
should have stopped him from getting on in the first place.
Dr. Nelson Ludlow, from the perspective of being the CEO at Intellicheck Mobilisa, okay, you've got a database security system. How difficult is it to merge information of how someone behaves at an airport with this other data that might exist in national security archives, that sort of thing?
Well, fusion of data is always hard, but if it's just to provide an alert, it's actually much easier. So there are systems that check 140 databases all in about a second, and at least it can just send up a flag, a red flag, to say, wait a minute, this guy needs some secondary, some additional security screening, and that's actually quite doable.
But then why aren't we doing it?
Well, that's a good question,
yeah.
Because, you know, currently Andrews Air Force Base, home of the president's airport, they have a system like that, and they're actually checking these databases. So why aren't they being used at our airports?
All right, Michael and Nelson, to both of you. All right, we design a great system. We can catch people if they behave strangely at the airport. All a terrorist has to do is actually check a bag and buy a two-way ticket, and the whole system goes out the window. You suddenly don't stop them, and the person gets on the plane. How do you deal with that, Michael?
Well, the nice thing about being a terrorist, if I can frame it that way, is that if you're sufficiently discreet and novel, you're going to be a success. And we're never going to be in a situation where we stop everyone. But the point is that we make the strongest effort we can to stop as many as we can.
And technologically, as well as using traditional police work. Dr. Nelson Ludlow, you want to take us out?
Okay. I agree with Michael. It's difficult if somebody's novel. And in this case, this guy actually was on one of the terrorist identity lists of about 500,000 people. So it's the other actions that he's doing, his preparations, the things. So he was already previously identified as somebody that should have got that additional screening.
Well, as a takeaway from both of you, I'm hearing this is clearly doable. Yes, yes?
Yeah,
absolutely.
All right. Michael Tanji, former senior intelligence officer and current senior fellow at the Center for Threat Awareness. He's a columnist for Wired's Danger Room. And Dr. Nelson Ludlow is the CEO of Intellicheck Mobilisa, which designed an international security database system that's actually been purchased by the TSA. And as he said, it's now actually being used at, what did he call it, the President's Airport, Andrews Air Force Base.
You don't often get that clear an answer when you ask a question. You don't actually ask a difficult question. They just say yes.
Right.
That's pretty rare.
It's fusing the databases, the database of what kind of behaviors are being exhibited by flyers at airports, and fusing that with this larger database of who's on a list and what kind of a list is it.
Right. Well, if you want to catch up on that, get the details on it, or anything else, you can go to our website at thetakeaway.org. We've been asking you about something a little different. Scientists at Emory University in Atlanta say dolphins are so intelligent, they deserve special rights, non-human as non-human persons. What do you think? Lauren says, sure, let's make our rights subject to intellect correct, totally politically incorrect, but there are a lot of dumb people out there. Maybe the world would be a better place if they had fewer rights. Going in
Lauren.
A different direction, Ed emails, I think we should work on giving rights to unborn human beings, and then we can think about giving rights to dolphins. Tell us what you think.
Yeah,
at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org.
I'm John Huckenberry, and I'm as smart as any dolphin, I'm telling you.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm Celeste Headlee, and I'm doubtful.
Call me
this
Flipper.
Is The Takeaway.
Question. What if your doctor thought of treating you, thought of performing an operation, say, like a mission to the moon? Hey, Doc, are we go for launch?
Booster.
Go.
Retro.
Go.
Vital.
We go fly.
Guidance.
Guidance, go.
Surgeon.
Go fly.
While lawmakers struggle with health care reform, medicine struggles to correct a culture of loners, judgment calls, and deadly medical errors. If we can put a man on the moon, can doctors find a pre-flight checklist to prevent disasters?
Launch control, this is Houston. We are go for launch.
In medicine, Houston, we have a problem. On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Huckenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. Thursday, January 7th, 2010, and The Takeaway in Medicine is how to find simple ways to avoid complex mistakes. And it's a lesson for more than just doctors and healthcare workers. It's from Atul Gawande. Dr. Atul Gawande joins us in just a moment.
Look, a mother could have told you ages ago about the power of the checklist.
That's part of the argument. Its simplicity is deceptively complicated.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Let's get right to the top stories. Later today, President Obama will let the public have a closer look at the missteps that preceded the attempted airliner attack on Christmas Day. The White House will release a declassified account of what happened, and President Obama will address the nation at 1 o'clock about its findings. We're learning about one of the recommendations this morning. ABC News is reporting the president has ordered a surge of federal air marshals to be in place by the end of the month. The plan is to deploy 3,000-plus marshals almost exclusively to international flights, while personnel from agencies like Border Patrol and Secret Service pick up the slack on domestic flights.
More on that latest security misstep. The LA Times is reporting that U.S. security officials planned actually to question the suspected bomber once his plane landed in Detroit on Christmas Day. Customs officials found the suspect's name on a watch list, but the plane had already taken off. Would a checklist help here? It's a complicated situation monitoring terrorism. Joining us now, as I mentioned, Dr. Atul Gawande. He's the author of the Checklist Manifesto. We're going to discuss checklists and simple ways of reducing complex errors in medicine in just a moment. But, Doctor, is this pre-flight checklist model a good way of dealing with something as complicated as, say, terrorism?
It is. The fascinating idea here is that we're struggling in a number of fields now with overwhelming complexity. And it's a shift from a world where our biggest problem was ignorance. Our biggest problem now is what you'd call ineptitude, things falling through the cracks. And the idea of turning to a checklist can be life-saving.
Well, narrowing those cracks, that's what it's all about. That's going to be the focus of our conversation. It's the focus of Dr. Atul Gawande's book, The Checklist Manifesto. He's a surgeon at Brigham and Women's Hospital and associate professor at Harvard School of Public Health. He'll be back in just a moment.
On President Obama's checklist, a tax on high-priced insurance policies as part of the final health care bill. He wants a 40% tax on individual policies that cost more than $8,500. House Democrats are resisting that tax would affect a number of union-sponsored health plans.
And just an indication of how complicated it is to conduct a census. Question number 9 on the census asks, are you black, African-American, or Negro? Now, the word has stirred some controversy since many feel it's offensive or outdated, but census officials claim it was meant for older African-Americans who still identify with that term. Looking at markets now, Asian and European markets are down. Wall Street gets underway in about a half an hour, and the futures are pointing downward. The Dow starts at 10,573 this morning. The S&P opens at 1,137, and the NASDAQ opens at 2301.
Coming up, we welcome our new listeners in Denver by talking with their mayor, John Hickenlooper. But during our conversation, he got a call that interrupted the interview. We'll find out who that was in just a moment. But today we're also talking about something a little different. Scientists at Emory University Atlanta, here's what they say. They say dolphins are so smart, so intelligent, they deserve status as non-human persons, and that comes with rights and protections. So we're wondering, do you agree? Could dolphins be that smart? And are there other animals that maybe should get personhood status? That's actually Spinbox. Somebody called in with that.
A dolphin called in.
877-8-MY-TAKE.
Fingers.
Send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. We're going to learn more about that during the show.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, everyone. All during the presidential campaign in 2008, and certainly since then, we've been talking about health care reform. Health care in America. How much does it cost? How to make it better? The current bill in Washington is all about changing the culture of medicine and the way we get services delivered to us. But maybe a deeper debate, a deeper discussion is in order here. It's often said that doctors are the heroes at the center of our healthcare system. Brilliant geniuses, surgeons, people with almost magical powers whose authority is often unquestioned. But that may be the reason why 10 years ago, when they started to really look at statistics in hospitals, perhaps as many as 100,000 people die of medical errors in medicine. Why? Perhaps it's as simple as not using the techniques of industries like aviation. We played that clip from Apollo 13, how astronauts use a pre-flight checklist to make sure they've got everything straight before they actually launch. The nuclear power industry even uses these kinds of techniques to simplify, to narrow the cracks, to make sure that all errors are covered before an operation, an event begins. This is really the theme of Dr. Atul Gawande's book. He's the author of The Checklist Manifesto. He's a surgeon at Brigham and Women's Hospital and associate professor at Harvard School of Public Health, a widely quoted healthcare expert and someone who writes in the New Yorker, fabulous pieces in the New Yorker magazine, which I'm a big fan of. Dr. Atul Gawande, good morning again.
Thank you.
Let's talk about this checklist model. How would it apply to medicine? And did you ever have to do a checklist before you did one of your own operations?
You know, it's funny. Using a checklist is something that often in medicine and other fields, people that we've put at a low status would be expected to do. We see it as kind of dumbing things down. But as experts, we think it's a sign of weakness to use a checklist.
Wow.
When you're seeing a patient, if you have some question, we just don't turn to something. We wouldn't pull out a textbook and say, let me look that up and see if I got that right. We fear people would lose confidence in us. And yet, we've reached a point where the complexity has overwhelmed us. We now have more than 13,000 diagnoses that we have to manage, 6,000 drugs, 4,000 potential medical and surgical procedures we can deploy for people, and we're trying to manage it town by town across the country consistently with less waste than we've had. That's part of the idea of reform, and we have to turn to some of these ideas from sometimes outside of medicine.
Well, and the VA system, the Veterans Administration system, has tested some of these ideas from NASA. I remember several years ago, the head of the VA hospital system was actually brought in from NASA, and some of these techniques were used to great effect in reducing medical errors. What concrete experience do you write about?
Well, one of the places where, you know, I never thought I'd be writing a book about checklists, but I was assigned a project to find a way to try to reduce deaths in my field, in surgery, with the World Health Organization. And when we started looking at the numbers, we're doing, for example, in the United States, 50 million operations a year for a population of 300 million people. And we've gotten unbelievably good at it. But you do that many operations, we found we have 150,000 deaths following surgery in the United States, a huge number, and at least half when we studied them were avoidable. What that means is that despite our emphasis on increasing technology, longer and longer specialty training, I go through 8 years of surgical training after I came out of medical school, and yet we're still having stuff fall through the cracks. And so we turned to an idea, let's try a checklist. We actually worked with Boeing to help learn how to make great ones that that pilots can use under crash circumstances where, you know, they only have a minute and they find checklists useful. And so we designed one for the operating room that was just a two-minute checklist and began implementing it in hospitals.
And what was the stats on how effective such a program was?
This is where it was a great surprise to us. We implemented it in 8 hospitals. This was a global project, and so they ranged from great hospitals in Seattle and Toronto and London to hospitals in rural Tanzania, India, Amman. And what we found was every single hospital had a double-digit reduction in complications. We tested in 8,000 patients, and we had a 35% reduction on average in major complications. We had a reduction of 27 deaths, which was 46%.
46%
drop.
Now, let's just stop right there. If I was a drug company and I came up with something that reduced deaths by 40%, even in trials, I'd be a billionaire, right?
Yeah, I mean, this is the fascinating thing. The part of the reason why this idea doesn't spread is its advantage. It's no cost. But because it's no cost, that means it's no revenue. You can't patent a checklist.
Right.
And so there's no, instead of having ads on TV, people would be flocking for this drug. You'd have marketers putting ads on television with celebrities touting it. And instead, we published these results a little over a year ago. And we've seen it now. 21 countries are committed to deploying it. And France went live. It's interesting, in systems with universal health care, they've been able to move quickly. So far in the United States, we're in about 20% of American hospitals. Partly it's not easy, but partly there is this natural resistance that we have to overcome to how experts see themselves. Are we willing to say, I'm going to take a minute just to check that I didn't miss the key things?
It's a cultural shift. It's a psychological issue for people who have been told they're brilliant, perhaps all of their educational lives. And, I suspect that was the case with you. You write in your book about how this is used to look at infection problems in hospitals, et cetera, and talk about some of the resistances there. But let's broaden this out before we go. I mean, I got to talk with you for an entire hour about this. But how do you think these techniques relate to complex issues like terrorism or dealing with, say, a disaster post-Katrina, something like that?
Yeah, the cultural level of this is the recognition that our biggest struggles now are not with managing our ignorance, but it's managing the volumes of knowledge we have in many fields, legal mistakes, software design mistakes, foreign intelligence failures. And it starts with that willingness to say, when pilots go into training, they won't let them near the plane until it's been drilled into them, you are going to fail. And if you don't accept that you are fallible, that there's too much to know, then you're going to die in that plane and you're going to take people with you. Mm-hmm. You need checks because our brains are limited. And then they work on the question of what are the checks in place? How do you make a good checklist versus a bad checklist? And this is something we need across multiple arenas. We've had a 1/3 increase in lawsuits for legal mistakes. We have the kinds of foreign intelligence failures we're talking about. The gaps are sometimes knowing the exact right things to do. In medicine, we see communication drops, like the ones we saw with this airline incident, are an increasing problem because we have more and more people involved in care and more complexity of knowledge that has to get through lots of people.
And the antidote to that complexity, the checklist, the simple checklist. Dr. Atul Gawande, the author of The Checklist Manifesto, surgeon at Brigham and Women's Hospital and associate professor at the Harvard School of Public Health. Thanks so much. And now at 15 minutes after the hour, let's take a look at some of the headlines.
In a few hours, the president will reveal the latest findings about the failed Christmas airliner attack. The 23-year-old Nigerian suspect was indicted on 6 charges yesterday. Some fresh economic news just out. The latest weekly figures on people claiming unemployment benefits increased. That's after 2 weeks of declines.
And we've just been talking about the unusually cold weather for a few days. Actually, it continues today. Forecasters say Iowa could get another 10 inches of snow as another winter storm moves across the Midwest. Wind chills in the Dakotas make it feel like negative 50. And Rob Anderson, Central Kentucky auto worker, is lucky he held on to the Powerball ticket he bought during some last-minute holiday shopping. After all, it was printed by mistake.
The clerk ran the $3 quick pick, but he put it all on one ticket. And I was like, doggone it, I needed 3 separate tickets.
Did you hear this story?
I did.
His winnings, $128 million. We're going to talk to the clerk who sold the ticket mistakenly. Ghazi Hussein is his name, later this hour. Was it really a mistake? I guess it depends
on your
point of view.
Maybe it was divine intervention.
Yeah, well, it was meant to be in any case. Powerball winner, we're going to talk to the clerk. Coming up, President Obama pushing for a tax on high-priced insurance policies. What does that mean?
Hey, you want that to go?
time for some news takeouts on stories we're following this week, and they are trying to reconcile the House and Senate versions of health care reform this week. In the meantime, President Obama says he favors a tax on high-priced insurance policies, so-called Cadillac plans, as a way to finance that bill. Todd Zwillick, our Takeaway Washington correspondent. Why is the president coming down on the side of taxing these Cadillac plans?
Well, the interesting thing about this, Celeste, is that the president has taken a side. So seldom in this healthcare debate has the president taken sides on any of the big issues. The House, the Senate, I should say, wants to tax these Cadillac health plans. There's a lot of money there, and when you tax them, it discourages people from having really rich insurance policies that drive up costs. The House does not want these things taxed. A lot of union members have these plans. These are not plans that rich people have. The president seems to have come down on the side of the Senate here, and he's taken sides, and it's going to be a tough sell in the House. They feel like they've given enough.
Well, I assume that this is also a field day for lobbyists, both from the unions and the opposing factions.
Well, they're going at this. The conference hasn't even started, if there's going to be an official conference, and the lobbyists are going at this hard. Think about it. These Cadillac insurance plans are owned by thousands and thousands of union members. So you have the SEIU, the labor unions, the auto workers, the steel workers, wanting this tax out. They like the Senate. The House version, pardon me. The small business lobbies are huge as well. The employer mandate requiring employers to provide insurance for their employees, that's in the House version. There are small employer requirements in the Senate version, but they're much less stringent, and there's billions of dollars at stake there. Everyone from the employers to the unions to the insurance industry, the public option is still in play, even though it's probably coming out. The insurers don't want that. And then, of course, Celeste, I know you like this one. There's the indoor tanning industry. They would love, I'm sure, for that tanning tax to come out that we've talked about. And I think they were caught a little off guard in this. I just want to tell you very quickly. In 2004, the Indoor Tanning Association spent $52,000 on lobbying. So far in this election cycle, just $8,000. I think they were on their heels. I didn't think they expected this one.
Thanks so much, Todd. Todd Zwillick's our Takeaway Washington correspondent.
All right, it was a squeaker, but in the end, Andre Dawson, outfielder Andre Dawson, got into the Hall of Fame.
The weight isn't a big factor in the scheme of things. You get frustrated when, you know, people continue to say, well, when do you think you're going to get in? And you don't really have the answer to that.
It's because outfielder for the Expos and the Cubs, Andre Dawson, got in his last year of eligibility. 77.9% of the vote. He's in, but Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen?
Well, I mean, Andre Dawson was well-liked by players. He was well-liked by the press. I think he would have been in sooner if he hadn't played it so many years in Montreal, and I'll tell you why, because he played those years on turf, and the turf busted up his knees. So I think that actually reduced some of his effectiveness. But he was a five-tool guy. He had power, he could throw, he had homers, he had doubles, and he could steal bases.
And he's pre-steroid.
He is definitely pre-steroid era. He was not pre-Jerry Curl era, but he was pre-steroid era.
But we're seeing in the voting in the Hall of Fame how this steroid issue is really going to manifest itself in baseball history.
And it's going to come up in the next couple of years. You're going to start to see in 2013, actually, Roger Clemens and some of the other guys that have been implicated in this, they're going to start to come up, and that's when it's going to really get really dicey for the sports writers to make a tough decision about who's in or who's out.
All right, quickly, we got to go, but the NBA suspended Gilbert Arenas indefinitely for admitting he brought guns to the Washington Wizards locker room. Did the NBA really drop the ball on this one, or did they have it right?
I think that they have it right. I mean, it was an incident that had happened last week between him and a fellow player where they both had guns in the locker room.
Wow.
So, you know, and at the team that used to be the Washington Bullets, this is a stain on their organization and it's a stain on the NBA. He's probably going to have to forego the rest of the $89 million left on his contract.
$89 million. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, Takeaway Sports contributor.
Good morning.
Okay, now here's an animal takeout. That's the sound of the actual highly evolved language of dolphins. We've known for a long time dolphins, they're pretty smart. Our next guest makes the argument that means they deserve rights, just like humans. Lori Marino is a neuroscientist and lecturer in the Neuroscience and Behavioral Biology program at Emory University. Lori, do we know how smart dolphins are?
Well, good morning. We have a number of indicators from our scientific findings over the past few years that show that dolphins are extremely smart and probably in many ways on a par with what we consider to be the most intelligent animals. For instance,
humans.
We know from the studies of their brain size and brain structure that they are second only to modern humans in terms of their relative brain size. And we know that the behavioral findings that we have of them is consistent with this.
So you actually call dolphins non-human persons, and you have a scientific argument that they therefore deserve special rights.
My argument is that dolphins deserve respectful treatment and compassion. And one of us, Tom White, who is a presenter in this meeting that's coming up, is making the argument for them as non-human persons as a legal term.
Huh. You know, Laurie Marino, I once talked to a neuroscientist who said if you could actually translate what what was going on in the brains of dolphins and hear what they thought humans were doing to the ocean, we wouldn't be able to broadcast it. It would be so nasty.
Probably.
You know, the other thing is that, Laurie, in some cases we don't entirely know how smart dolphins are because there's some things that they can do that we don't understand yet.
That's right, and that's the problem with the fact that we're treating them the way we are, incarcerating them and slaughtering them all over the world. We may never know exactly what we're doing.
Okay, Laurie Marino is a neuroscientist and senior lecturer in the Neuroscience and Behavioral Biology program at Emory University. And that leads us straight to the question of the day, John.
Yes, indeed. Should they have rights?
Based
on brain size, based on these intelligence issues.
Grace emails us. She says, give them the status. I believe dolphins are more intelligent than humans. They don't have lawyers, politicians, guns, drugs, Hummers, expensive yet ugly handbags. And it seems to me they know how to have a good time. So long and thanks for all the fish. Let us know what you think. Do dolphins deserve rights? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Coming up, we talk with New York Times columnist Nick Kristof, and here's a solution to the problem of extremism overseas. Successful development, more effective than unmanned drone attacks. Talk about that in just a few moments, but first here's some news stories we're following at 30 minutes after the hour. We're getting reports of a workplace shooting going on right now in St. Louis. Reports from the St. Louis Post-Dispatch say three people have been shot at a power company there, and the gunman, reportedly armed with an AK-47, is still on the loose. The shooter reportedly worked at the company for many years. We'll have more details as they become available. We're also learning more this morning about the Christmas Day bombing attempt. The LA Times reports that U.S. officials found the suspected bomber's name on a watch list, but the flight was already in the air. They'd planned to question him when he landed in Detroit. The president told House Democrats yesterday they should include a tax on high-priced insurance policies. That's a measure that was favored by the Senate.
Let's check markets. As expected, the Dow and all the Wall Street indices have opened lower this morning. The Dow's about 40 points lower, the Nasdaq down about 3 points, and the S&P down 2.5 points. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
We must also be honest that in some situations, we will invest in places that are strategically critical, but where we are not guaranteed success. In countries that are incubators of extremism, like Yemen, or ravaged by poverty and natural disasters like Haiti, the odds are long, but the cost of doing nothing is potentially far greater.
That's Secretary of State Hillary Clinton in a speech yesterday where she talked about her new vision for international development efforts. We're joined now by New York Times columnist Nick Kristof. He's been reporting on international development for years. He's also co-author of Half the Sky, Turning Oppression into Opportunity for Women Worldwide. Good morning, Nick.
Good morning.
So when Hillary Clinton talks about investing in places that are strategically critical, we've done that in other places where we've been fighting extremism and terrorism. That's Iraq and Afghanistan, and I guess possibly they're going to use this in Yemen. But tell me exactly what we mean. When we say investing in development in these countries, what are we talking about? Are we talking about building roads?
Well, it's frankly a little unclear right now exactly what she does mean, and we've taken a lot of different approaches. One approach has been to work with aid workers closely allied to military folks in these things called provincial reconstruction teams, where they go out, and it tends to be quite controversial because it does involve the military in these development efforts. And the other approach that we've taken that I think has been, frankly, much more effective has been to simply support local projects. In Afghanistan, there's a wonderful program that helps local communities build an irrigation program, a school, a things like that, and things, support things like education, which I think are utterly transformative in a way that dropping bombs often isn't.
Well, you've outlined kind of the problem with a lot of international development efforts in these areas, and that is that even if it's aid that's coming from an NGO, a non-governmental organization, very often on the ground, people see them as being linked to the military, and they suspect anything that's linked to the military, even if it's a development effort. So how do you get around that?
Well, there's been a, within the aid world, there's been a deep suspicion of these efforts to involve the military in these kinds of programs. Frankly, my own view is I'm a little more sympathetic to it simply because the military has the money. I mean, at the end of the day, the Pentagon spends more on its military bands than the entire State Department has for all of its diplomats. And so given that the military, if the military isn't involved in digging wells or building clinics, then those clinics are not going to be built and the wells aren't going to be dug. So I'm a little more sympathetic to the argument that, bring them in. But, yes, there are real concerns about whether that does taint aid work in an area.
But isn't that exactly the argument that people in places like Iraq and Afghanistan make to themselves? They see that the U.S. investment is overwhelmingly military and not in the development side. And so, in a sense, until we reverse the investments and really upgrade what we're doing on the State Department side, people aren't going to take us seriously.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, where there have been some real efforts on the humanitarian side, they really have had a significant effect. And I'm thinking, for example, of the effort by the U.S. to help after the Kashmir earthquake. That had an astounding impact on Pakistani public opinion, but it was temporary. It lasted about a year or so. But,
But that's a year. I mean, in terms of Pakistani time and the view of the U.S. in Pakistan, that's a big deal.
That's right. And there are no silver bullets here. And we've invested very heavily on the military side in Pakistan, which is, maybe the most crucial country in the world right now, really teetering on the edge. We've spent about $13 billion since 9/11, mostly supporting the Pakistani military. And it's accomplished essentially nothing. And in the meantime, if we had invested some share of that in education, then there, wouldn't have brought any immediate result. It's not a quick fix. But by now, you would really begin to see some real changes in Pakistan, especially in those tribal areas, that I think would have tended to bring a little more stability.
And Nick Kristof, we're hearing this argument on a number of different levels. We just had the criticism of the CIA that they supposedly were too focused on the enemy and not focused on the Afghan people, and that's brought some problems for the intelligence agency. Is that more of the same kind of problem?
I think so. Likewise, when we do aid, you also tend to have these big, huge programs that are, planned from afar, and less of these small-scale efforts that really involve local people. And, in Afghanistan, I'm thinking about something called the National Solidarity Program, which is one of the few programs in Afghanistan that is really widely regarded as a great success. And it involves only about $50,000 a project. The local community is involved in committing their sweat equity, sometimes their local materials, in building something like a school, and involved in the decision making. And it really has had a remarkable effect, and including in building support for the U.S. And in addition, since the local people have helped build something, they resist when the Taliban come along to try to blow it up.
Are we seeing also, though, in Iraq and Afghanistan particularly, and I'm thinking of this bombing last week, that the Taliban and al-Qaeda are maybe targeting some of these civilian operations as a way of really discrediting the whole hearts and minds operation and resisting the ability of people to recruit civilians into these programs?
That's certainly true, and we've seen that in Pakistan as well. But it tends to go for they tend to target these larger programs that local communities don't really feel a strong sense of ownership in, a strong stake in. In contrast, the Taliban largely leaves alone these small-scale initiatives in which the local community has help build it, simply because that would antagonize the community, and often the Taliban come in part from that village itself. So those have been largely immune, and I think we can learn something from that.
That's real success is a cover. That's a fabulous takeaway. If you're having real success, the Taliban leaves you alone because they know the people love the program.
Yeah, and, you know, education, I think, is another example of that. The schools that have been built in Afghanistan by CARE, for example, or by Greg Mortensen, those have not been blown up. Those are still operating.
Wow.
And that's because the local community, they think of them as their schools. There may be some U.S. fingerprints on them, but they're pretty distant. And that's really what can be done in these places, and it does contribute to stability.
That is great. Nicholas Kristof, columnist for The New York Times, co-author of Half the Sky, Turning Oppression into Opportunity for Women Worldwide. Thank you so much. Coming up, welcome, Denver. We talked to your mayor. He's thinking about running for governor, we hear. He got a special surprise while we talked to him. So we talked about a lot of things.
I'm sorry, that was the governor's calling me on my cell phone. I won't take it.
Is he asking you if you're going to run?
I don't know.
We're going to talk to him and find out what the conversation between him and the governor was later this hour. This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Huckenberry. We reported this yesterday. A federal court in the Ninth Circuit in Washington State this week overturned a law that said convicted felons had no right to vote. We're joined now by Dale Hoes, assistant counsel for the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. They've been working on this case for the past 6 years. Dale, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
You know, my first question is, where does this doctrine come from where you remove the right to vote from people who are convicted felons? We're talking about Washington State in this case, but it's really an issue that manifests itself nationally.
That's right. There are 48 states and also the District of Columbia that in some form or another deny the right to vote to people with felony convictions. And from our perspective, what's most important about this case is that no one should be denied the right to vote because of racial discrimination. And what the court found was that because Washington's criminal justice system is infected with racial discrimination at all levels, a point which the state of Washington itself conceded, then Washington's law, which denies the vote to people with felony convictions, is also racially discriminatory and violates the Federal Voting Rights Act.
And that's the same approach that legal challenges to the death penalty took, that avoid the moral issue of the death penalty itself and focus more on if you're going to have a death penalty, are you overwhelmingly executing one group over another?
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, a lot of the challenges to the death penalty have focused on not so much, as you say, whether or not the death penalty itself is morally correct, although that is an important question that society continues to grapple with, but whether or not it's applied fairly or if it's applied arbitrarily. And that's, in some sense, the same sort of issue that we're grappling with here. Is disenfranchising people who have felony convictions something that's fair, or is it something that's arbitrary based on factors that are unfair? And in this case, it was determined that it was unfair. It was based on race. At the time this lawsuit was filed, an astonishing 24% of all black men and 15% of the entire black population in Washington were denied their voting rights because of a criminal conviction. Now, those are huge numbers, and the evidence showed that these disparities were not reflective of actual participation in criminal activity.
Well, let's take the statistics out of it for a moment, because I'm sure some listeners would want to know from you, if there were no statistical issue here, no racial issue here, do you believe the state has an interest in withholding and disenfranchising people's right to vote based on their conviction of a felony?
Well, the state might have an interest in that, but from our perspective, really the only issue is, does this comport with the Federal Voting Rights Act, which prohibits racial discrimination in voting rights laws? And in this case, it was shown that the denial of the vote to people with felony convictions was racially discriminatory. And if I can make one more point about it,
please.
This issue has national significance. We have 5.3 million Americans in this country who are denied the right to vote because of a criminal conviction. And in 10 states, people convicted of some or all felonies are barred from voting for life, even after they've been released from custody.
Huh.
And 2 million of those people, roughly 38%, are African American.
Where does the case go from here? I mean, those statistics are amazing and certainly electorally significant. Where does this case go from here?
Well, the state of Washington announced yesterday, or the Attorney General anyway, indicated that they plan on seeking review at the United States Supreme Court. So the United States Supreme Court is going to have an opportunity to decide whether or not to hear the case. And if they decide to hear it, that's probably we'll go next.
And we will talk to you again in that case. Dale Ho, assistant counsel for the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, talking about that decision in the Ninth Circuit yesterday, which overturned a law that said convicted felons have no right to vote in the state of Washington.
You Good morning. I'm Celeste Headley. I'm here with John Hockenberry. You know, John, have you ever had an interview that you've been doing interrupted by someone taking a cell phone call?
It's pretty annoying, yep.
It is. Yep. Although I would argue that in the upcoming interview with Denver Mayor John Hickenlooper, it might be excusable. We're going to talk about that in a few moments.
Ooh, what's that about?
First, here's a check on leading stories in 47 minutes after the hour. We are getting reports that a gunman has opened fire at a power company in St. Louis. At least three people have been shot, and the gunman is still on the loose. The shooter reportedly worked at the company for many years. Fox News says at least one victim is presumed dead. Some employees at the business ran to the rooftop to escape the gunfire. At least one man barricaded himself inside a maintenance room. The first December sales reports are coming in from the nation's retailers. They're showing modest holiday gains.
And do we have time for this? Rob Anderson, Central Kentucky auto worker, is lucky he held on to a winning $128 million Powerball ticket he bought during some last-minute holiday shopping. It was printed by mistake. Anderson, you see, meant to buy three $1 lotto tickets as stocking stuffers, but the clerk made a mistake and gave him an additional Powerball ticket instead. With us now is the clerk who sold him the ticket, Kazi Hussein, an employee of Pro Travel Marathon on Kentucky Route 62 near I-75. He joins us from Georgetown, Kentucky. Kazi, good morning.
Morning, how are you?
All right, so three tickets you printed out, the lottery ones that Anderson asked for, then you printed an additional Powerball ticket. What happened then?
No, I didn't print three tickets individually. I just printed one ticket because he didn't tell me he wanted, you know, three tickets.
How mad was he? Was he pretty mad when you did that?
No, he wasn't mad. He was cool. He said, I don't want it, but there's a guy who was behind him, and he said, I'll take it if you don't want it.
The guy behind him?
Changed his mind. Yeah, somebody was behind him. You know, some other guy, customer, he said, if you don't want it, I'll take it.
Oh,
but the rock changed his mind. Yeah, he said, I'll take it anyway. He printed it out.
I'll take it anyway. A $128 million decision there. Thank you, Kazi Hussein, employee of Pro Travel Marathon, joining us from Georgetown, Kentucky. I was thinking in my mind, who could have gotten that ticket if it was a mistake? $128 million. Just all around
Denver all day. This week, we're welcoming our new listeners into the Takeaway family, with those who are listening on KUVO and KVJZ in Denver. And Denver residents, we talked to your mayor, John Hickenlooper, from his office yesterday. The news is the governor of Colorado, Bill Ritter, ended his bid for a second term, and Mayor Hickenlooper is believed to be a strong candidate for the seat. The last time we talked to him, he talked about the growth of the city, his plans to develop it sustainably, and a lot of that depended on the development of fast tracks, six commuter rails that would extend out from Denver to its outlying communities. And we asked the mayor how that fast tracks program was being affected by the recession.
It's been affected two ways. You know, right at the very beginning of the recession, there was a huge spike in the cost of steel and concrete. So the cost went up dramatically, 30-35%. So they got hit that way. And then, of course, when the recession really hit, sales revenues dropped. And this was being paid for by a sales tax. So the price went up. The revenues went down dramatically. Now, the commodities prices have come back down, which is the one silver lining. But they haven't come down as much as the sales taxes have dropped. So we're still pretty much underwater, and we have to decide whether to go back to the voters this fall and say, hey, we're going to need another 0.3 cent sales tax.
Right. You asked them for a sales tax hike in 2004, which they approved, but there's a $2 billion gap between the cost that you're talking about and the revenues that you have coming in, right?
Exactly. That's a rough justice. It's a little more than the $2 billion.
And do you think the people of Denver have the stomach to approve another sales tax?
Well, you know, in this economy, if you go out and poll it or go out and talk to people, they're so fearful that I think it would be difficult to pass. But once people sit down and kind of really think through it and understand it, you know, we've been talking for about the last 2 months to various groups, and they get pretty excited. You know, again, it's all about how much congestion can you diminish for how much does it cost you. So when we first went out with Fast Tracks, we told, and this was the facts, for 28 cents a day for the average taxpayer, you will save somewhere close to 24 minutes. That's like a buck an hour. Most people say, God, I'll do that in a second. How do I get an extra hour of my day for a dollar?
You know, and the other news coming out of Colorado is that your governor, Bill Ritter, is not going to run for re-election in 2010. Do you have any aspirations to the governor's office?
Well, you know, we'll certainly look at it. You know,
That's positive.
Yeah, sure.
That hits some lights here, yeah.
Yeah, all right, whatever.
So let's talk a little bit about hitting that 5 million mark for the state. We had the Denver Post staff writer Bert Hubbard on earlier this week, and he talked about a strange thing going on in Colorado, and that you're attracting a lot of very highly educated people to the region, but they're not necessarily people who grew up there.
it's not just attracting anybody. It's attracting very highly educated individuals. There's sort of a contradiction in Colorado in that it ranks among the top three states in the nation in terms of the percent of people with college degrees, but it ranks relatively low for those people with high school degrees, which means it's really not educated. So
you're the state is pulling people, highly educated people from outside of the state in, but not educating them right there at home.
Right. The governor refers to that as the Colorado paradox, that we have one of the most highly educated populations in the country in terms of the number of graduate degrees and undergraduate degrees, and yet we have also one of the highest levels of students entering ninth grade who don't graduate from college. You would think with all these intelligent people moving in that our school systems would do better. What happens is a lot of the people moving in don't have children right away, their families aren't growing at a rapid rate, and we have a large number of immigrants, both legal and illegal. We have a large number of undereducated individuals moving in, and they have many more kids. And for whatever reason, we have not succeeded in making sure those kids learn. And, you know, it's at the top of it's been the governor's one of his highest priorities. I think whoever the next governor is going to be is going to have it the exact same. It's got to be right at the top of their list.
There's another kind of strange oddity about Denver, and that's that one of the businesses that's booming here there is the medical marijuana business. There's a report in Portfolio that said there are more marijuana stores in Denver than Starbucks. I wondered how you feel about this booming business.
Here's my thing. You know, over the holidays, I had two close friends who had very close family members, with one with pancreatic cancer and one was inoperable brain tumor. And both of them were so appreciative that there was medical marijuana, right? This is something that, for those people who are getting the worst news of their life, it's something that makes their quality of life a little better and is such important. What everyone's worried about, and I think, you know, all these dispensaries for medical marijuana are suggesting to people that there's abuse, that people are, you know, gaming the system. And, you know, we'll crack down on it. The reason there's so many here right now is because right now there's no regulation, right? This just got passed. So, of course, there's a tidal wave of people trying to open these up. But I don't think that's going to happen.
Okay, so we've talked about a lot of things.
What? I'm sorry. The governor's calling me on my cell phone there.
Really?
I won't take it.
Is he asking you if you're going to run?
I don't know. I'm not going to take the call. I'm talking to you.
Okay, great. Well, let me ask you, of the topics that we've covered,
Let me just finish about medical marijuana.
Oh, okay.
I mean, we will regulate it very closely, and I guarantee you that a lot of those stores will close down because this is not a get-rich-quick scheme. This is a way to provide people the stuff that's important.
Well, it sounds to me...
Can I put you on hold and call you back in 1 minute?
As long as you tell us what he says.
Exactly.
All right.
And he actually did call us back after just a couple minutes, and we obviously immediately asked him what the governor had to say.
He was very gracious, just wanted to tell me that he was at my disposal, that if I wanted to talk about his reasons and why he was not going to run and the job and, you know, the kinds of stress that it puts on your family.
And the job.
He said, you know, if you want to talk to me in the next 8 hours, I'll make the time. If you want to talk to me, if you want to spend some time with your wife and then talk to me. He was very gracious. He's one of the most gracious people I know.
It sounds like you better give your wife Helen a call.
Exactly.
Yeah, well, Helen's going to have more than a little bit to say in all this.
Well, it sounds to me like you have, just in this conversation, you have the makings of a platform, John Hickenlooper. I mean, I think at least you got that covered, right?
Well, the issues around education and, you know,
sustainable growth.
Right, exactly.
Public transportation.
Infrastructure.
Public health. Look, I could make this whole platform up for you myself.
Want to move to Colorado?
But seriously, we have moved to Colorado. We got new listeners in Denver all of a sudden. And I wonder, for the rest of the country who's listening, where do you think Denver is ahead of the rest of the United States, and where do you think it lags behind?
I think one place we are ahead is there are so many people that have moved here. They want to live this lifestyle, and that allows the community to come together, like around Fast Tracks, a transit initiative. You know, we had all 32 mayors unanimously supported in 2004 a 0.4 cent sales tax increase. I've never heard of that in another part of the country, where the whole region collaborates and works through an issue like that and comes up with a solution. So that's something we do better, I think, than anyone. You know, one of the things that we obviously, I think, need to work on is you know, this issue around education. You know, if you're going to say the one thing you want Colorado really to be known for, I want it to be the best public schools in America. Safest cities and the best public schools.
Well, good luck with that. Some real challenges. That was Mayor John Hickenlooper from his office in Denver, Colorado. Who knows? We may be getting more news from him. Maybe an announcement.
I feel like we were a fly on the wall there.
Really?
Yeah, you know. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.